Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Behind Massive Screens, a game development podcast here from Massive Entertainment in Malmö, Sweden. My name is Dori, and I am continuing on my onwards plan of taking over this podcast completely. First, I joined as a co-host, and now I'm doing the intro.
Yeah, I thought, you're not doing a good job. I keep showing up. You keep unlocking the door. That's your problem.
So far.
You're always first in the room.
So far. Also, yeah. Petter is here.
I'm here. I'm still. This is my life. Hey, everyone. Welcome. How are you, Dori?
I'm good. For those of you only listening on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, you should tune into the YouTube version to see my glorious holiday sweater.
I'm in the festive spirit. Beautiful.
It's pretty awesome.
And if this comes out in January, tough. We're recording in December. It's Christmas.
You can become all nostalgic thinking back to the wonders of the holidays.
Yeah, if stores can start decorating in November, I can wear Christmas stuff in January.
Next year, we're going to spray paint your beard white.
Yes.
We're
going to
complete the whole thing. We have a guest.
Oh.
Yes. Oh, we can sit here forever, but we have a guest. You want to do the introduction of the guest as well to complete the kind of the takeover?
No, I'm not ready for that yet.
Okay.
That's for next podcast.
All right. Welcome very much, Drew, game director here at Massive Entertainment.
Thank you so much.
So a little story before we get started. You've been on quite a lot of, you used to work on The Division, Division 2.
Absolutely.
So you've been on a lot of like streams and podcasts and stuff before.
Yeah, yeah.
You had a nickname in the Division community.
I might recall a little bit. I don't think I feel comfortable saying it.
Okay. Drew used to be called Drew Cena in the community. Maybe because the thing is, you were always on stream with like community developers and game designers, and our arms compared to yours are quite a lot smaller. I'm just saying. So welcome, Drew Cena.
Welcome
to the podcast. How are you?
Thanks. I'm great. It's super good to be here.
It's awesome to have you here again. It's been way too long. So the first question we always ask, we need to ask it again.
Yeah.
What does a game director do?
That's a good question. So, I mean, it's mostly about providing kind of high level direction for everything that is gameplay. Right. So you can, in essence, right, you can kind of split a game into two parts. It's not a perfect split, but like you can basically say, well, there's like features or gameplay, and then there's content, right? And those are the kind of like the two major families. Now, in reality, there's tons of crossover, but a game director is really responsible for like kind of directing, leading the kind of gameplay or the feature aspect of it.
Right.
So that's everything from like, you know, like the game design teams, the gameplay code teams, gameplay animation, like all that kind of stuff.
Sounds like you have a lot of keeping your head at the same time.
Yeah.
We always talk about
surround yourself with great people and then.
I
want to make sure that I understand it correctly. If you could say that it's like control of the gameplay aspect of it rather than the story content.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not so much about the control, but it's really like the kind of like responsibility to kind of like ensure that everything kind of like comes together, that you're providing some kind of like high level direction and you're like kind of like steering a ship. You're not the one, you're not the engine, you're not the steering or the components that actually like make it happen and are like super critical to it. You're just like the person like steering the ship and being like, hey, I think we should turn left here, you know, like,
The one with the schematic saying like, it's going to come here, it's going to fit. And overseeing the assembly, maybe.
Yeah.
So how many meetings are you in a week?
That's a good question.
How
many meetings am I not in a week?
Exactly. We're very grateful.
Yeah. No, it's of course, it's a make time anytime.
Yeah. Because we talk about almost every time we end up talking about communication between various teams.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you definitely have to have communications with so many different people.
Yeah,
all
for
the
sure.
Time.
That's a huge part of the job, right? When you work on AAA games, you know, team sizes can range anywhere between, you know, a couple hundred to many hundred, right? Of people, sometimes across multiple continents, right? Time zones, all of that stuff. So communication is one of the greatest obstacles, and it's a huge part of what a lot of people do, but especially part of my job as well.
Yep. The other question we always ask, because it's always fascinating, and I know you have quite an interesting story about how you ended up at Massive Entertainment in Malmo.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
How?
Yeah, how?
that's the question.
How indeed. Do you want the long version or the short version?
Oh, we have.
Like we always say, it's an hour podcast. I mean, we have time.
Yeah, good.
We want to hear it. So.
Yeah, so I actually went to university to be a teacher. And I taught middle school for a year graduating after I graduated university. But kind of the whole time I really like wanted to be a game developer, right? Like I thought of being a game developer was like the same as like professional athlete, like a rock star. And then I was like, game developer, that's like number three. If I can't be one of those two things, like game developer would be like
the split. Like went to university to become history teacher, professional athlete, rock star.
Right.
And then game developer.
Yeah. So definitely not a professional athlete, not even close to a rock star. Game developer, I got.
Oh, you got Drusina in the end. So it was kind of a rock star. And anyway.
Yeah. No, but it was, you know, it was something always in the back of my mind, but it wasn't really a reality because, I mean, we're talking like when I first kind of had this idea, it was like, you know, around year late 90s, early 2000s, right? And, you know, like game development education, especially in the United States, especially in the Midwest, wasn't really a thing. There really weren't that many opportunities outside of a couple places. And, you know, it was a bit of an unclear path to get into games, right? So I didn't even think that was really a possibility. So went to university, you know, was always really into like coding and like kind of like making games on the side. And then that's actually really when I got into modding as well. And that became kind of an obsession. And, you know, and I just always assumed that that would be just something I did on the side, right? But then ended up moving to another place. So I was in Indianapolis. And then I moved to Houston, Texas. And Houston, Texas actually had two game developers that were there. And there weren't any game developers in Indianapolis. And I remember my now wife, but she wasn't my wife at the time, was like, hey, you know, you're looking for teaching jobs, but look, there's game developers. I know you want to be a game developer more than anything, right? And so I applied, obviously, and I kind of like used my modding experience as like my foot into the door, right? And I remember I'd applied for like a level design position that I probably wasn't very qualified for, really, looking back, But the recruiter was like, hey, we filled this position already, but would you be interested to come in as for a QC position or QA, as called in the States? And I was like, yes. So I show up, full suit, tie.
I think that's beautiful.
To an interview, right? I'm told later that everyone was like, who is this business person that's coming in? And like, why is he here? Are we getting fired? Like, you know, these are all the thoughts going through people's head.
Your sex are here.
Yeah. You know, in my mind, I'm like, oh, I gotta dress up, look nice. Yeah. And then, going there, I immediately felt stupid, but it was all right. I got the job, right? Yeah. So it turned out okay. And then was there for a while, worked on a few games, mostly multiplayer shooter titles like Section 8 Prejudice.
Right.
Worked on a game called Aliens Clone of Marines that maybe a company more heard of. Mm-hmm. And then the company went bankrupt and like closed. And there was a guy that I had worked with. And he's one of those guys where like he seems to like always know everyone and everything about the game industry, right? Like he's just like this kind of omniscient presence in the game industry. And he had reached out to me like probably a year before the company closed and was like, hey, I'm at this really cool place in Sweden. You should come. Like, we're definitely looking for like game designers. You should come. And I was like, well, you know, things are going pretty well. My wife just graduated, you know, with her master's degree. And like, yeah, it's like she just got a job, blah, 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 blah. So like, I think we'll wait it out here. And he's like, well, he's like, I just want to let you know, like, I can't tell you anything about the game, but it's going to change the world. You know, and I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. Year later, company goes bankrupt, closes the doors, right? And I contacted him again. I was like, so.
About that job.
Tell me about it. And actually at that time he was like, well, it's summer. He's like, we're closing down.
Yeah.
Right. And he's like, but check out E3. And he didn't say anything more than that, but he's like, check out E3. So I check out E3. And of course this is 2013.
Right.
And that's the big reveal of the Division.
Yeah.
And that like blew my mind because I was like, wait, that's the studio making this game, you know? And I was like, oh, I got to do it. So then I like came for an interview, the rest is history. Moved at the beginning of the next year.
Yeah.
After all the work permit stuff was sorted in the move, and it's been a blast.
That trailer keeps coming back in these interviews.
Yeah.
Fredrik Thailander
it's
was
so
here
good.
In
episode so good.
2, I think, of this podcast, and it was the same for him. He saw the trailer and
yeah,
I'm going there.
Yeah,
but I've got to work on this.
Yeah, and it's funny too because like I mean, and Fredrik and I would. We still talk about it, but like we would talk about it all the time in like Division 1 and 2.
Yeah.
And same with like Ada and Matt and everyone else. Like we would just constantly talk about that trailer, like because it was such a game changer at the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Most definitely.
Yeah.
But weren't in QC the entire time you were at?
No. Yeah. So I was in QC. That's like kind of where I got my foot in the door. I learned so much. I think I was there for maybe 4 months or something like that. And it was like, you know, in developer QC. And I think at that time there were only 4 of us or something like that. So we're a pretty small, tight knit group. Used to play Left 4 Dead every lunch together over LAN, turn off the lights.
Yeah.
And then I actually got into community management, which I knew nothing about other than that I'd seen other community managers on the forums that I was on.
Sure.
And did that. And like kind of at the same time, I ended up kind of like running a beta, doing some production work with like the gameplay team, handling bug reports, surveys, and like analyzing data and making recommendations, scripting events. I like kind of progressively moved more and more towards like game design.
Right.
And then at a certain point, it was like, hey, there's a design position open. Like, would you, Drew, be interested in this? Or like, do you want to continue on the path? And of course, I was like, no, I want to be a game designer. So, that's kind of where I got my foot in the door there. And then, you know, and I worked on all sorts of systems. And that was like kind of actually the nice thing about working at a smaller studio. I think we were 100 people or something at that time. So it meant I got exposed to all sorts of different systems, got to learn so many different things about, you know, controls, camera systems, scoring systems, progression. And then eventually like AI.
Yeah.
And that was something I was doing the last, you know, couple years or whatever. And in addition to some of the other things like working on weapons and camera and controls and stuff. And then that's when I came to Massive, you know, I was able to specialize a bit more. And that was kind of like my major focus on Division 1.
Yeah.
Now, I have to, because you dropped a name in there that piqued my interest.
Yeah.
Alien Colonial Marines. Yeah.
Yes.
Can you, I mean, that must have been early in the life cycle of that development or the first or second life cycle of that development.
Well, we saw it through. Mm. So, I mean, it's been so many years, but basically, right. So I was at a studio called Timegate and we were working with Gearbox to make the title. And so it was a collaborative effort between the two. I think you always learn a lot on every project you're on, but I think especially that one was such a great learning experience. There were just so many opportunities to get into different things, to also witness completely different ways of working, which of course you see things that you want to take with you later on, and also, you know, some things that maybe you do differently. Mm. And you learn equally as valuable lesson from that.
Yeah.
It's also a crash course into interesting AI, speaking about AI, yeah. Watching an alien come to life.
Yeah, yeah.
Watching the Xeno come to life.
Yeah.
But AI, yeah, you worked on AI for The Division and The Division 2. What's it that fascinated you with AI? How come you like kind of wanted to specialize in it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think AI was so interesting in particular because it's such a complex topic, right? Like when I had worked on other systems, you know, you design a system and you kind of understand where you want it to be in the end. And then once it kind of reaches that point, of course, there's always like maybe some small tweaks and improvements or whatever, but you can basically look at it and be like, it's done. But with AI, you're never done. It's just this completely iterative process. And it's all about prioritization. And, you know, you can kind of have somewhat of an idea of what you want, right? Like high level. But when it comes down to it, like the actual implementation, it's so like, it's such a, like something that you have to feel. And and it's so complex. It touches everything, animation systems, tech art. You have to know about character art and like Animtek and motion planners and narrative server client infrastructure
as well, I guess, like how the,
yeah, a bit of that too, right? Of course,
to behave,
like, yeah. So I mean, it's
looking at the first game, for example, the difference between fighting a hyena and fighting a hunter, for example,
For sure. I think it's a super fun place to be, and it's also one that's pretty technical, especially, you know, in Snowdrop we have amazing AI tools. Like I don't want to make this claim because I feel like it's maybe too bold, but at least at the time it was, I think, industry leading in terms of the debug tools that we had. There were a few GDC talks and stuff, that I had the pleasure of sharing with Bill Dunstan, but also a couple other people like Jonas Julberry did as well. It was stuff that no one else was really doing yet in that field. So like just being a part of that was super cool.
I just want to say one thing. I had to look it up. Hyenas is in the second game.
The hyenas is in the second. Kill me. Yes. Yeah. You're thinking of the rioters.
Rioters. Yeah, yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah. So, I didn't want
to correct. Sorry to all the Division fans out there.
Yeah. Just clip it before he fixes it.
Yeah.
Hit him up on Twitter.
Yeah. Don't at me, bro. sorry. But what's like watching, looking at AI, like looking back, the way it's developed, the way it has to become more complicated. People have much higher expectations.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, just thinking back to the first time my first experience like with AI, when you start thinking about AI, was Half-Life.
Yeah.
The first one.
Yep. For sure.
When the soldiers come into the base.
For spoilers. Sure.
And you're fighting them, and
they start flanking you, and
they start barking. Like it barks at the time as well, like grenade out or fire in the hole or what they're shouting. And I remember playing it with a friend, and we're like, "What is going on here?
Totally.
What is happening? They're not just enemies." And then looking at when stuff get even more complicated, like in Fear, when Fear was released.
I was gonna say Fear was to me like the defining moment of AI. I mean, that was. I mean, sure, some of it was. I mean, that same as today. A lot of it was just like smoke and mirrors. But that's the beauty of it, right? Is like as a player, you don't know the difference, right? Yeah. And that's so cool.
Yeah. Like we were told, I think in the last podcast, game development is all smoke and mirrors.
Yeah,
and
totally.
It doesn't matter if you're actually doing it or not, if the person playing feels like it is.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So how do you, I have to ask this question when I have you here. How do you even start working on an AI system?
Mm.
Because there's so many branching paths that have to make so many decisions.
Yeah.
Like how do you have a character.
Yeah.
Okay, now act.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean the first thing, right, is understanding like what the architecture looks like, right? So like we use behavior trees in Snowdrop.
Right.
Right. And you know, and then like games like Fear, they use like a goal-oriented action planner, GOPE. And there's like a couple other like models as well that are used. But like once you know that, then you can kind of understand how to like think about the problem. And so, you know, a behavior tree is basically, you know, if you can essentially think of it as like a bunch of like if then statements,
mm.
right? And you just, you start at square one and then you figure out like, what is the first thing I need to like figure out if I'm doing or not doing? And then you just kind of like work from there. But really, you know, you figure out at a high level what you want to achieve first, mm. before you even begin to like, to actually like write that stuff, you know, and then you think about like, okay, do you have a detection system? Okay, well, like what kind of states will there be? Because that's going to inform how you set things up. What kind of things will you react to? Are there a lot or are there like very few? Will they have like bespoke reactions or like very generic reactions? You know, like, will they just always play surprise and stay in place? Or will they like run away from a grenade? Or maybe they'll like throw it back sometimes, or, you know, like all of those things have a really big impact on how you set things up. So, but yeah, other than that, it's, I mean, this is, I feel like this is such a cop out, but it's just like a lot of like hard work and like, you know, iteration.
Yeah, you know, I was just about to ask, because if one, it has to be a lot of iteration, considering if one gameplay element changes, the behavior of the enemy could like make zero sense anymore.
Yeah. I mean that, and that's true. Like you don't like, you definitely need to like solidify at least the core, like, with the Division, it was like, okay, it was a cover-based shooter.
Mm.
But if for some reason at some point in development, we were like, we're no longer a cover-based shooter. Wow. That would have had a huge, huge impact on how everything was created. So it's true. But I mean, that wasn't going to change, right? Because we knew like that was a tentpole, so to speak. But there's other things you can do though, to kind of like mitigate these things. Like, okay, what if the player has this skill? Well, what if that gets cut and we're replaced with a different skill?
Mm.
And it's like, what you want to do is you want to build something that's modular enough that like, you know, it's essentially just like turning off things or like making a small adjustment in one place, not in many places.
Right.
You know, in Division 2, I think we shipped with something like 73 different enemy archetypes, I think, which was a lot. But the only reason we were able to maintain that is because we used a lot of modularity, where a lot of the NPCs were like sharing different components and you could tweak them on like a per NPC level, but like the underlying tech itself was all kind of the same. So, so that way, if you did have a major change, you could, you know, you'd only have to make it in one or maybe two places. And then that would propagate to all 73 NPCs.
So you had like a master behavior tree basically. And then,
yeah,
it was tweaked for all of them. But if you made changes in the blueprint, then it...
Yeah, you can kind of think of it that way. Yeah. I mean, in reality, it works a little bit differently than that. It's all about using what we call compound nodes, which are basically like little instanced groups of like logic that you can input different like variables and like set different flags or things like that in. And it, depending on that, like you get a different output. But yeah, it's essentially, you know, another way to think of it is kind of how you're describing it.
Yeah. It's just when you were describing like how you go about it from start to finish, it sounded like you want to build a brick wall and you have the blueprint and you start laying the bricks,
yeah,
but they're making the bricks as you're putting them in.
Yeah.
So you know, there's sometimes this different one is sizes. Slightly different shape.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so you have to adjust. I mean, you do have that plan, and that's what you fall back on, and that is going to be, you know, at least 80% correct or whatever, but then there's 20% agility and adaptability that's required. Yeah.
I think it's interesting as well that you can make an AI too good for the players. Any situations where you felt like, okay, we need to scale this back? Like watching the hunters in the beginning, for example, they were crazy.
Yeah.
The way they acted. It's like, have you had like moments where you go, okay,
yeah,
we've done too good of a job with this enemy.
Right.
Scale it back. Scale it back.
I mean, I think one of the really important things, right, that I learned, I think it like, especially like kind of early on, right, was that when you work in AI, it's not about making the smartest AI. Right? It's really about making the most fun AI, right? Like you're always servicing the game, right? Like the AI isn't there to be like amazing AI. It's there to service whatever the game needs, right? And that's just to kind of create like the most fun possible. So in a game like The Division, of course, right? the AI is intentionally built to have all sorts of flaws that you can exploit as a player, right? Like the grenadiers, before they throw a grenade, they're going to tell you they're going to throw a grenade, and then they're going to expose themselves. And then they're going to be like, no, but seriously, I'm throwing a grenade. Look, 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 throw. And, you know, and of course you can hit them and they drop it on themselves and then they fall to the ground because, oh my God, there's a grenade right there. And then they try to escape and then it blows up and it kills them. Right. And hopefully as a player, you're like, I'm smart. I'm skilled. That was fun. Yeah, exactly. Whereas, you know, if like the NPC was just like, threw the grenade real quick, you know, and like,
from because out of cover.
Like, yeah. And, you know, it like landed right on you and it knew exactly like how long to prime the grenade so that you couldn't escape. Like, that wouldn't be fun, right?
No. Yeah. And I mean, that's also another thing, because inside of a computer game, you as the player are inside the world that is controlled by the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
The AI of the enemy is controlled by the game. So technically he always knows where you are.
Yeah, totally.
So it's like how that information is propagated, like when he should be able to see you.
Yeah.
And also you want to have him, you know, patrol in a certain way so that, you know, that the sneaking portion is free. Like,
totally. Yeah. And so, I mean, and that's interesting, right? Because we have to develop all of these systems that kind of simulate the like awareness of NPCs, or like the detection of NPCs, like of the player, right? To like simulate like, oh, they like lost where you were and they still think you're over here when in reality you're over here. Like, we call those last known positions, right? Mm. And I mean, they're super fun as a player, right? Because you can outsmart the AI and feel smart and you can feel like super proactive, right? But yeah, there's a surprising amount of work to make that happen, right? Because the alternative is like, yeah, of course we know where you are on the server. Of course we know if we're going to hit you. Of course we can hit you whenever we want. Like, of course, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like kind of like working your way back in a way to just make it as much fun as possible.
Yeah, and then you just tune that up and call it hardcore mode.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but then what's really interesting with that, right, is if you look at the Division with like the legendary NPCs,
yeah,
it's like, of course, like we could make them like pinpoint accurate and everything. And like, you know, they are very accurate. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. But we still needed to have those little windows of opportunity, right? But instead of them being a second or half a second, they were a tenth of a second or something like that. So we were really playing with it. But if we removed it completely, then it wouldn't really be very much fun. And then we would be almost asking players to just like suffer and not know how to improve because there's no room. Or like as a player, like the one thing that you can kind of do when it feels hopeless is exploit, right? Because there's always going to be some kind of like strategy or something that you might be able to find where like, you know, we hadn't thought of, or something was maybe even broken or just not, you know, robust enough for us to like solve a difficult problem or an edge case or something like that. And that's not very fun, right? I mean, maybe for some players it is, but...
Well, in Dark Souls, it's very rewarding to do the cheese tactics. That's how I finished the second game, I think.
Yeah.
You wrote an article, plugging our website a little bit.
Yeah,
you wrote an article about AI and the myths of AI.
Yes.
Yeah. That's up on massive.se/blog.
Yeah.
And do a little search for Drew or AI.
And you'll find it. Link is right in the description somewhere.
Yeah.
Right. I keep forgetting we have that.
George, can you write down the link in the description?
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Done. You don't have to go look for it. Okay, fine. There was one thing about the... Drew is tearing apart the scenery.
Yes.
The studio. One thing I just want to bring up before we leave this topic is... When Frederick Thailander was here, he talked about a certain enemy type in the first game where the backpacks exploded when you shot at them.
Yeah.
And he blamed the solution on you.
Yeah.
Putting like a shrinking down an enemy and then having that just fire everywhere.
Making them invisible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's such a brilliant, beautiful solution to a problem.
So
speaking of smoke and mirrors and video games.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in that case, right, it's one of those things where we knew what we wanted, you know, and it was like, they have this ammo back and, you know, because video games, you shoot that thing and it like has that like kind of like popcorn effect and fires bullets everywhere. And we want it to be like a chaos creator, right? But we actually didn't have an ability to fire bullets unless it was like an NPC or a player.
Right.
So like we couldn't just have like a random object fire bullets. Why? Because like we didn't, like our weapon system didn't run on like props, you know? And so, yeah, so the obvious solution then is like, well, we could do this super expensive thing that's going to take forever. And like, who knows actually like how good it'll be, how much control, because then we have to port all these systems to it and everything. It's like, or we could spawn a tiny invisible NPC who has terrible accuracy and is like firing all over the place. And yeah, and I remember putting that in and one of our... gameplay programmers, Robin, was like, he's like, you did what? I explained it again to him. And then he was like, you know, that's not the worst. And then we shipped with it. So,
well, I love how especially like AAA video games or video games in general, can be they are extremely complicated projects. Yeah, but yeah. Sometimes it's just the easy solution.
Yeah, totally.
That
totally.
Makes the biggest yeah. effect.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. One thing you started talking about before that we're going to delve into a little bit, because if somebody has experience in a crazy modding project, a highly ambitious modding project that you made.
What are you
No, sure. You're not punning me. No,
sure. My Duke Nukem maps I made when I was 16. Highly, highly ambitious level. No, it's you, Drew, obviously. How did you, before we talk about that particular project, you were like modding was a way for you to get started.
Yeah.
Making video games.
Yeah, totally.
How did you get into it? What tools did you use? Yeah. When did you get started?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first mod tools that I used were Never Nights 1.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'd actually toyed around with some mod tools before that, but it was so complicated.
Yeah.
Right. It was like, I didn't even know where to begin when I was like looking, you know, at like Half-Life, for example, like trying to mod that. I was like, what am I looking at? Right. Yeah. And in those days too, it was really hard to find good resources online, because the internet was kind of
sure. I was
not
actually,
as much
I was
of a actually, thing then, I guess.
I was actually thinking about that, after we had our meeting, yeah. We talked about modding tools and I was actually thinking about my Duke Nukem maps.
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand and remember, yeah. This is like 25 years ago. How did I do this?
Yeah.
How did I learn without right. having resources everywhere, yeah. forums to go to? How did I yeah. even learn? Is it a readme file in the install directory?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
I mean, other times it's just, you just play around with it long enough and you learn.
Sure.
And in my case for Never Nights 1, right, it was so easy to get into.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time too, there was an amazing community. And so like forums were like the place where you could ask questions,
yeah.
where you could find other people asking the exact same questions as you.
There was also a really nice tool for Neverwinter Nights with the standalone program.
Yeah.
It just had a couple of drop-down menus.
Yeah.
Like, I want to do this. I want the character to go there to a specific
yeah,
point.
That's right.
I want
that's
to spawn
right.
an object.
Yeah.
And right. you click generate, and it would generate the code.
Yes.
And you can just put that in a
yeah,
script.
Yeah, the script generator. I think Lilac Soul was like, the,
yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
person.
That's the one.
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
and that was that helped
it was
me.
Brilliant.
To, yeah. It was
but
really
but that's
good.
Actually I'm that's how I learned Neverwinter script. It was actually putting in a bunch of things there.
Right.
And being like, because I didn't really understand the context. I understood a little bit because I you know, had done some coding and everything, but I wasn't entirely sure about like what functions existed and what they did and everything and the,
right.
and the syntax and doing that. I learned so much. I remember, I think actually like even with kind of the first big mod that I released, I think if you look at like all the scripts, I bet there's still some portion that will say generated by a script generator, Lilac Soul
yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
there's probably still some of those in there.
But like just like to explain the Aurora modding tools that was
yeah.
called,
yeah.
why it was so easy to work with compared to if you're looking at other modding tools, especially at the time. Because
yeah.
I tried Divinity 2, which is kind of similar genre to Neverwinter.
Yeah,
Nights 1,
yeah.
And I tried their modding tools, and you're just looking at a black screen going, okay, so quit. I'm out.
Right.
While Aurora Engine was really easy to work with.
So easy.
Just the way you could place objects, place
so easy.
Environments, everything.
Exactly. Was, yeah, I mean, everything was tile-based for the map.
Yeah.
Right? And so, like, and at the beginning, you were basically asked kind of like, how big is the map? Okay. And then I don't remember if this is, so now I'm like getting Neverwinter Nights 1 and 2 mixed up, but I don't remember if you made the choice then what kind, like what style, if it was a dungeon, if it was a forest or whatever.
I think so.
So I think you did at that point, but otherwise it's after, but it was the, regardless, it's super easy because you have these menus clearly labeled. They made the game with the tool set in mind, right? Yep. And the developers use that tool to make the campaign.
You can actually open the campaign in the modding tools.
Yeah, exactly.
Check out how they
exactly.
did
it. Exactly. And you can do literally every single thing yep. that they did. And which, by the way, is also, you know, one of the ways that I was able to learn the engine was by just opening the campaign. And because I had played the campaign, I was like, how did they do this like cutscene or whatever? And it's like, oh, that's brilliant. They're hiding the player. They're making him invisible. And like, I mean, it was just such cool stuff to like learn at that moment.
So yeah, just boot it in and then read the code for the function that you're looking for, how they did.
Yeah, exactly.
Ah, that's nice.
Yeah. But the just the user friendliness of that engine. I mean, you could make a map in under a minute. I mean, it wouldn't be a good map, but it would be a map.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, I still don't think there's an engine today that you can do it that quickly and get in game and just like run around in it. It's amazing.
I think it's still worth actually investing in, if you're interested in modding, interested in telling stories and just want to make, maybe not so much focus on your own gameplay and your own kind of genre or whatever you want, but a way to tell a story because you have all the conversation tools. You have everything that you can dream of. And the conversation tools, for example, really easy to work with as well.
Yeah.
It can get really complicated, but it's still easy to use. So I think it still might be worth as a beginner to actually take a look instead of, hey, I'm downloading Unity and driving myself insane. Maybe pick up Neverwinter Nights on Steam and get started in the tool.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's still, and there are still like multiplayer servers running.
Yeah, there are.
City of Arabeth,
it's still pretty, it's still a pretty active community.
Yeah.
And I mean, in these days, right, it's, I mean, I moved to Neverwinter Nights 2 kind of exclusively at the end of 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's a more powerful tool set in a lot of ways, but on the flip side, it does actually come at the expense of kind of usability,
mm-hmm.
right? So no longer can you just like quickly, like, put out stuff on a grid. It's like, okay, the exterior areas, you're actually like painting terrain. And then interior areas, it's like, yes, it's still tile based, but you have to make the tiles match up.
Right.
You know, and it's just it's just a little bit extra effort. It's not difficult, but it is a little bit of a learning curve.
Yeah.
And it's different camera and everything like that. So, you know, the attention to detail is different. It's higher fidelity, which also makes it more time consuming, and you have to kind of do your own lighting and stuff like that.
So, going into Neverwinter Nights 2 now, and the crazy project you started.
Yeah.
Like, this is one of the most ambitious modding projects I've heard of, actually. What did you do, Drew?
Yeah, what did I do?
What did you do? If I Google your name, what will I find on the internet?
Yeah, I that's a good question. I don't
know. I can do it
now. I truly don't know. But yeah, so I before I got in the game industry, I had a crazy idea, which was, you know, this tool set for Neverwinter Nights 2 has all of the things that I could ever need and want to remake Baldur's Gate, because Baldur's Gate was and is like my favorite game of all time. And there's such fond memories of playing that game. And I remember, like, I tried a little bit Neverwinter Nights 1. I got up to the Friendly Armin, which isn't that far. And then I remember being like, you know, it's just it's too limiting. Like, the tools aren't there to like really like, or not the tools, but the kind of areas themselves just aren't, it just was like not robust enough to like feature the kind of landscapes and things that I wanted to do. So Neverwinter Nights 2 came out. It was like, this is perfect. And I'm completely naive. I've never made a game before, really. Like, I had made some silly things in high school that were like, you know, board games and stuff, but, you know, on PC. And so I started, I 2006, and then 7 years later, I released it.
Yeah,
so
you,
it took
you,
7 years.
I think you said. I think you said in the interview we did before that that was not the time frame you expected.
Oh no, not at all. I had no idea.
No.
I mean, when I started, I was like, "How hard could this be?
How hard can right? it be to remake?
How hard could this
one
be?
One of the biggest RPGs?
I was like,
history.
You know, like, look at this. I've got this engine." People already like made this. Like, how hard could like implementation be? Oh wow. So yeah, I fully expected that I would be done in about, I think, like 2 years or something like that. Mm. And I'm pretty sure I told my wife that too.
So that's why she in the end, like, just get a job in this so you get paid right. instead of working on this crazy project.
Yeah. So, but it was really cool, right? Because in doing this, like I learned a ton. And like early on too, I started to learn that there was so much more that I didn't know. Like, because I mean, I thought I didn't know a lot, but I was like still like learning and I was like, oh, okay, I kind of have like a general feel. I kind of understand how to do this. But then as you really get into it, I'm like, oh my gosh, I have no idea how like all these like pipelines work, these workflows, you know, and there were so many things around like just game production that I had just never thought about until I had like really started to get into it. And that's actually where like I worked with another person, because there were like in the modding community in general, when you're working on a big project, there's always like kind of a large kind of transient group of people, right? They like come and go, they like maybe like contribute a couple things and then they go, right? Because no one's paid. It's no one's job. They're doing it because they love it, you know, and it's just like passion. And so, you know, like real life happens, people's interests shift or whatever, right? And they don't have time. So they drop out, right? But I was lucky enough to have a person who helped out co-developed like Baldur's Gate Reloaded, which is the name of the remake in Evernights 2. And I think we worked on it for 5 years together. And there was a lot too that I learned about, like just the coordination that you have to do and the communication that you have to do, right? Because one person, it's super easy because everything's here. You write down only what you need to write down because you might forget it. But when it's two people, all of a sudden, you know, you're like, well, I really want this like translation of Baldur's Gate to mean this. Well, that person doesn't know that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I need to convey that some way, right? So you need to like figure out how to like talk about it. And then you need to reinforce it. And then you need to talk about when that doesn't align. Maybe actually because, you know, you're doing it together. Maybe you actually need to compromise. You need to shift. So there's so many cool things that you learn along the way.
Yep. So, and in general, what do you think if it's a good place to start if you're interested in game development? We talk a lot about like tips and tricks and where should you get started and things with the people who come to guest us. And obviously modding for you was a big way into the industry.
Totally. I think modding is one of those things where like I think early on in the industry, that was kind of the way to kind of like get a job in the industry was to mod, because there, you know, there wasn't formalized education, and beyond just like having a friend, it was like, that was kind of the way to learn and to get your foot in the door. But I think modding, you know, like modding tools have kind of been on the decline, right? And that's for a ton of reasons, right? Games going more multiplayer and you can't really do modding so easily with multiplayer games. But also like, you know, with that, I think that, you know, I think we lose something really special, right? And that is, I think modding is a great educational tool about how to make games, but also how to think about how to make games, right? Because one of the beauty of modding something is you're actually taking a finished game, a finished engine, something that shipped a game, and you are using that to make a new experience. So you get to see all of these super talented, smart people, what they finished.
Yeah, their and solutions to, and their approach.
Exactly. Mm. And you can learn so much. You learn like, okay, why did they do this? Like, and then you read in code. They make a comment. They're like, I'm doing this because
make a tiny invisible NPC?
Yeah. Exactly. And it's really, really cool, right? You learn that and you take that with you, right? And then you can use that approach as well. Because in game development, right, it's not always necessarily like the best ideas that always win. I mean, sure it is a lot of times, but a lot of times it's also like the most like cost effective right? Because
and time effective.
And time effective, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, sorry, when I say cost,
it's, yeah, it's kind of the same.
It's
ruined by,
that's what I mean.
Ruined by the industry.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it sounds.
Time is money.
Yeah, exactly. No, but you know, like, but all games have this problem, right? Where you have a set amount of time to make a game. You always would want more to do everything perfectly, but you can't, right? So you have to like figure out what is the quickest, best bang for the buck way to make something. And I think modding is a wonderful way to kind of learn that because you say, okay, well, what do I have right now that I don't need to make from scratch? How can I combine that in interesting ways to make something that, you know, spits out something super cool and fun at the end?
I think for me personally, or what I feel now about like modern modding is coming from Neverwinter Nights as well, like getting my start there. Start in modding. Jesus, it sounds like I actually created something in my life. I never created a mod. But started to poke around in it there, and then going to do games like Dragon Age, which is still kind of complicated to work with, but still manageable. You can create some cutscenes, create some scenes fairly easily in that. But coming to more modern engines, like I had some idea for a Skyrim mod, booted that up.
Yeah.
And again, just like, no. It feels quite intimidating now.
Yeah.
For me going in with modern day modding tools.
Yeah, for sure.
How do you get over that kind of that step?
Yeah.
You think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. So I mean, I think like a lot of things, right? It's really, I think it's about setting the right expectations, right? That it's gonna take a while and that's gonna be a learning process. Mm. Right. Because it is one of those things where you step into it, you're not gonna know everything and you're gonna have to learn. Right. And that means starting small. You know, it's not like from day one, you're like, I have this amazing idea. I'm going to make a rideable dragon. Mm. Like, no, like that's not where you're going to be on day one. Right. It's going to take a while. And I think having that expectation is, especially for like more modern tools and engines, I think is super helpful. Mm. And there's so many good resources out there. There's so like, what I love too about modding is there's always this community of people that are just there to help, right? Because they love it. Like there's no financial incentives for anyone in the modding community, right? Like people do it because they love it, for the love of making games, right? And I love that, right? Like I love making games. I'm super lucky to get paid to make games because otherwise I'd just be making without getting paid.
Right.
So, but yeah, I think that, you know, like relying on that kind of knowledge and expertise that these people have and nowadays, right? Like I sound old. But now there's videos, right? Like on YouTube, there's like tons of different tutorials, right? That you can watch. I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah. I outed myself as a quitter.
Yeah, I mean, I did as well. I remember modding in the original GTA.
Yeah.
But that was just drawing on sprites, basically.
Yeah, right. You know, right.
Adding penises, being very edgy. Yeah, yeah.
Right. The old Civilization 2 had that as well. Just open up the big maps and then.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in Max Payne 1 on PC.
Max Payne 1? You could mod Max Payne 1?
Yeah.
You could if you wanted.
Yeah.
I mean,
what a sneaky.
I never got really far or made like a level or something, but people were.
Yeah.
You
look so guilty when talking about this for some reason.
Yeah. It's because. I don't know. I think what you mentioned before was like opening it up and there's just nothing.
Yeah.
And then closing it down.
Yeah.
That was me. And I've always felt kind of, I don't know, bad about it because I wanted to do that.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I didn't. I went to, and you know, did films and stuff as well instead. George showing off a GIF on the side. Great for the audio portion of the podcast.
Yeah, definitely.
But I know
I have no idea what's going on.
But yeah, I went into, you know, film and found my passion there and then kind of merged back into gaming by covering games with video. But, you know, somewhere in there's always this little developer that never got the nurture that he needed.
Yeah. We should mod something.
There you go.
Yeah.
Pick a game, any game.
I mean, I hear Neverwinter Nights is pretty easy.
That's download.
It's a good one.
I'll dig up my old CDs.
It's a good one.
We'll
if you guys wanna, you know, help out on Baldur's Gate 2.
I was just about to say, it's not, your journey is not over yet.
I know. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you did because that's
it'll be about seven years too.
I'm trying just to imagine. Yeah, probably.
It's been six. It'll be about another year.
I'm just trying to imagine someone is sitting in it. Like first, like the hypothetical person just sitting at home going, "I'm gonna recreate Baldur's Gate." Yeah. That in itself is insane.
Yeah.
But
like you what, did what it. Rational person that, would do that? That
nobody. Really, no rational.
It's a bad
person
idea.
Would. But at the end of the day, you did it. So remaking Baldur's Gate 2 kind of makes sense.
Yeah,
I guess.
Well, I mean, so basically, what happened, right? Is shipped Baldur's Gate 1, and it was the end was pretty rough. I remember voluntarily crunching, right? Like I don't have a boss. I just arbitrarily decided that I'm gonna finish. Now, I think I did something really stupid, like drank a bunch of 5-hour energies, and I think I slept 4 hours in like 4 days or something, and just like crunched to the very end to like ship this thing. And I remember like for about a year afterwards, I'm like, I'm never doing that again, ever in my life. I am done. I can feel happy about this. Like I released some patches. And then about a year later, the person that I had worked with started poking me, and, you know, and of course I at the same time kept thinking about, you know, if I were to do it again, there'd be so many things I'd do differently. You know, and especially at that time, I was in the game industry now. So now I had like learned all sorts of things. And so I remember like thinking about this. And then at the same time, you know, my partner had poked me and was like, you know, I really have been thinking about Baldur's Gate 2. I think we could do an amazing job. Like think of everything we learned, right? And of course, I'm at the same time thinking, oh, yeah, that's great. So then I remember working in secret from my wife, not telling her about it, and then very sheepishly bringing up, I was like, well, you remember that 7-year project that I just finished? I'm going to do another one. And I've been working on it for 6 years. It's a remake of Baldur's Gate 2 and the expansion Throne of Baal. It's called Shadows of.
You added in the expansions.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Just for good measure, because it wasn't
exactly.
big enough.
Exactly, exactly. Because it wasn't ambitious enough. I was like, you know, someone's gonna play this and be like, why did they even like?
Oh, the flaming of the forums, just because it's missing.
Right. But no, it actually has been a super fun experience, and it's crazy too. Like you never stop learning. No. Like every single day I learn new things. And this time around, right, it's been a lot more learning about animation, rigging, pipelines of getting all sorts of kind of art assets in, which I didn't have a ton of experience with before.
Right.
It's been really cool. And then of course, learning all sorts of new like production pipeline workflow stuff. Yeah.
And getting 10-hour energy drinks instead of 5.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Now, one of the main things that we always, I always bring up is the accessibility to game engines.
Yeah.
And for me, I always thought of that as like the very best way to start getting into game development, because you have these free tools and the asset store. So that if you don't want to focus on creating something specific, you can get that from the asset store and focus on your craft that you want to learn.
Yeah.
But now I'm kind of coming over to the modding side. But how would you like compare the two? Do you think one is a step to the other, or?
Yeah. I mean, there's value in both, right? I think modding is a bit more of like a generalized approach, which I think is really good for starting, because you kind of learn how everything works and you kind of also can find what you're interested in. But yeah, ultimately, like I think if you're really interested in making a game and you kind of want to do it quickly and you have like a cool idea, then like the asset stores are such an amazing.
Quickly.
Yeah. I mean, it's not
relatively,
quick, right? Relatively quickly. Right. Less than 7 years. I think like we think about like Unity or Unreal, you know, like all the different like asset stores and like all the great resources they have that you can download and stuff. I think that's an amazing way to do that. I think you still learn a lot of things, right, in doing that, but it is in some ways, right, it is a larger barrier of entry, because I think starting off, you don't even necessarily know what to look for or like how to do things. Whereas I think modding, you're already starting with a finished product you get to see kind of all those things, and then you get to kind of like deconstruct the things that you want to deconstruct. And it's not, you know, you're like intentionally breaking it, whereas the other thing, it doesn't exist and you have to like figure out how to make it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, also with the game engine, talking about YouTube tutorials.
Yeah.
Like, it's swimming with how to do stuff. And I actually,
yeah,
bringing it back to me trying out modding, not too long ago, I was like, you know what? I'm working at a game studio. I should know a little bit about what I'm talking about. So
yeah.
I picked up Unreal. And I decided, okay, I have this character and I have a skeleton that doesn't match and I have a movement set. Now I'm going to make it all together. I'm going to rig.
Okay.
And that took a couple of weeks and never really worked properly. And then later I found out, oh, you just chose one of the hardest profession inside of gaming to start with.
Totally.
But it kind of gave me a newfound respect of, oh, you don't just pick up a game engine and start making stuff.
Yeah. I mean, and It is funny too, because I remember like learning, you know, like 3ds Max or like ZBrush or something like that. And the amount of like, of time where like, you know, you just spend like getting lost in like these, which, you know, you think it's going to be a simple thing. And then it turns out that like you're picking like a super difficult thing that takes years to like master or whatever, you know, and it's because you don't have that background knowledge to really like understand like, you know, where you are, where you're going.
And I think maybe what I noticed in watching YouTube tutorials for Unity, for example, you tried Unreal. I was poking around Unity and some tutorials make it sound a lot simpler than it is.
Mm.
Like, especially animation. I was watching some talks about 2D animation and 3D animation. It was like, oh, it's really powerful. Just do this. Oh, okay, I'm going to try that. Right. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, you skipped over 5 different menus, and I don't even have the menu that you have. Yeah.
And 4 years of education.
Yeah. And but it's like, you know, you talk to like our character artists or something like that, right? And they'll sit there and, you know, in ZBrush or Blender or whatever, and they'll just like, super quickly like make this amazing like character or like prop or whatever, and you're just watching, you're like, wow, that's amazing, and wow, that didn't take that much time. And then
I can do that.
Yeah, exactly. And you're like, well, sure, like I could get started, maybe I'll be a little bit slower. No, it's like it's like 100 times slower, like
if you're interested in what Dory tried out and failed at. Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's fair,
it's fine. Yeah. Go back and listen to our tech animation episode number 4, maybe. We have an episode on tech animation, so go listen to that. It's really good. To kind of start wrapping things up when it comes to modding, your favorite mod of all time? The most impressive mod you can think of?
So, I mean, I think there's, I mean, obviously, right, like it's hard to discount all of the, like, I mean, like Dota, right? Like, I mean, it's like, that was a mod.
Counter-Strike. Like
Team Fortress, Counter-Strike. Yeah. I mean, these are, it's kind of mind-blowing, right? Because these things are so established now. But I think not to pick one of those. I mean, in the Neverwinter Nights community, right? There were some incredible mods that were made. And there was like one guy in particular named Adam Miller who made some really amazing things in both Neverwinter Nights 1 and Neverwinter Nights 2, especially the beginning of Neverwinter Nights 2. And I remember he made, I think as a joke, he made this, like, I think it was called Loot Hero. That was like a Guitar Hero, like spoof, but in Neverwinter Nights 2. And like, it was just mind blowing that this, you know, the CRPG could be used to make a Guitar Hero game, you know, with the crowd like cheering and like, you know, the notes going by and like having to press the keys. Like, what? How do you do that? Right. And then like you look and see how clever it is. And then there was like another like card game that he made, I think called Pirate Cards, which again, it was the same thing. I mean, to me, the impressive thing was using an engine that was clearly made to make, you know, like CRPGs, and then use it for something completely different. Yeah. You know, that was mind blowing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Later on went on to inspire Gwent.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
For coming, Drew. I think we could sit here and talk about modding and AI for a long time, but we're having George sitting in background waving. Well, it's getting... So blame George
yeah.
for cutting this short.
But yeah, thank you so much for listening and or watching. And remember to send us an email on behindmassivescreens@massive.se mm-hmm. for any suggestions or tips. If you want to complain about how he got something wrong about the Division 1, go right ahead. But we'd prefer if, you know, that you have a specific discipline within game development that you want to hear more about, or a specific person within Massive as well.
I really wanted to say something rude about you, but I couldn't think of anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so send us an email about how much you like Dory. Or me, considering he's trying to take over the podcast. Also, rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you're listening on.
Like and subscribe.
Like and subscribe.
That's it.
Smash the like button. Bye.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.